Hello, I'm Jason, and this is my podcast here at pointsinfocus.com. If you are a returning listener, welcome. If you are welcome back, if you are a new listener, welcome. This is episode 13, and this week we are going to be talking, or I'm going to be talking about something I talked about 2 weeks ago in episode 11, and that is packing gear for hiking and carrying. I've narrowed down the topic a little because I'm continuing to refine the ideas and the principles and whatnot as I spend more time working through the problems that I've run into or I am running into. So I should start with a little bit of background. And this background is really there for you to understand where I'm coming from. This is, you know, everybody's going to have what you're doing, where you're going, how your photography is, what your interests are. That's all going to be different for everybody. And that's going to mean that everybody is going to have to kind of pack with a, you know, what your problems are going to be and how you have to solve them are going to be different than the problems that I have. So, like I said, I'm talking about packing for hiking and carrying. And the reason that I'm talking about packing for hiking and carrying is I'm soon to be going out to the national parks out west. And while I won't be doing any backcountry hiking, I will be spending a good portion of my day walking around carrying my camera gear. And so some of this more than likely will be on non-paved trails with elevation changes and so on and so forth. And that's the problem, the environment. The equipment that are the focus of this trip for me is basically landscape and wildlife, if I run into any. That I'm not sure how much wildlife I'm going to actually see where I'm going to be. So the wildlife thing is kind of secondary. But on top of that, I've got some other things going on. I'm going to be riding the Durango and Silverton narrow gauge railroad. So I'm going to do some train pictures. I'm going to be doing a doors off helicopter flight out of Las Vegas. So I'm going to be doing some aerial work. And these kinds of things obviously all have different sort of requirements and needs and have to be sort of weighed in that context. As a bag, as I've mentioned before, I'm carrying I usually am a think tank backpack guy, but for this trip, because of the walking and whatnot, I decided I was going to get a hiking pack style backpack, and I picked up a F-Stop Gear Ajna, and I talked about that in episode 0 or episode 1, and so I'm not going to go into any great detail with that, but that's sort of the package. And for anybody who's listened to this show or listened or read my site, I'm a Canon guy, so I'll be talking mostly about Canon cameras. Nikon users, you can just substitute in, you know, Nikon professional level gear like the D800 or D500 and or D5 for that matter, instead of the Canon gear that I'm talking about. So, you know, there's a sort of direct correlation. The problem's going to be largely the same. Mirrorless users gain some, going mirrorless would gain some small amount of reprieve and some not, because ultimately, if you're shooting a full-frame mirrorless system, you're not getting that much smaller. Sony Alpha, A7R2s, A7S2s. Yeah, they're smaller and lighter than my 5D Mark IV, but the glass is all essentially the same size and weight, because if you're going to shoot with a 24-70 f2.8, it has to be that size, that the physics and the optics dictate that the lens has to be about the same size as anybody else's full frame 24-70 f2.8. So it doesn't, there's a little bit of a reprieve, but there's not a huge reprieve. So I mentioned where I'm going and what I'm doing, because that sort of is the first thing you have to deal with. if you're not going somewhere for where you're going to be in varying environments, obviously that would mean you could carry less gear potentially. If you're going to be somewhere, going somewhere where you're not going to have to carry your gear for appreciable amounts of the day, then you can carry less gear, obviously. So, you know, since I'm trying to share what I've run into, I feel that I need to share or share what I've learned, my thoughts, etc. I feel like I have to also share some of the, you know, like, this may not apply to you. If you're flying somewhere to do portraits for a client that, you know, you're going to be on a set, you probably won't have to carry your gear with you continuously because you'll be in one location. And so your packing situation is going to be a bit different. So when I was packing to go to Alaska in 2015, spring of 2015, one of my major concerns, the whole thing was flying, that it was not the gear I was carrying, it was making sure I could carry the gear onto the plane with the airlines. And that was one of the reasons that I got the Agena, because even if I can't carry the whole backpack for whatever reason, the camera unit that I have my camera gear in, I can easily pull that out and carry that on and check the backpack if I need to. But at the time, and this also goes in with talking to friends of mine who are go to Africa every few years, they're actually, I think, in Africa. Well, they're in Africa when this podcast airs right now, doing a photo safari or whatever you wish to call it. That the big concern in my thought process up until all of about two weeks ago, really, was I was thinking about flying. And flying, you have size restrictions and you have weight restrictions. And for most airlines, you can carry, I think, about 50 pounds of carry-on in your carry-on. It cannot exceed 50 pounds. And so that was sort of, to me, the I won't say hard limit, but the thought limit of what it was carrying. And what I'm realizing as I begin to validate and revalidate my ability to carry gear for extended periods of time, in walking and, you know, walk a mile with 45 pounds of gear and see how good you do if you're not used to it, is that it's not really the airline that's the limiting factor. It's the hiking and the carrying of the gear on the trail or all day. That is a much bigger limiting factor than the airlines. All told, if I fully load my camera bag, my, you know, internal camera unit, it's a large Pro ICU if you're looking it up on or you're interested. All told, if I load that with all the gear that I'm anticipating taking and throw a tripod on my backpack, and I have a carbon fiber Gitzo, so it's not exactly heavy, I'm looking at about 35 pounds. If I add water, that's another 6 pounds. And then when I chuck in all of the, you know, a set of rain gear and some extra, you know, snacks and that kind of stuff, I'm up to pretty close to 45 pounds or 50 pounds. And that as a whole is actually quite a lot of weight. And, you know, I won't be carrying all of that, obviously, on the plane. The payload for the plane is 25 pounds. That's just the camera gear. You know, the backpack, I'm kind of ignoring the weight of the backpack, but the camera gear alone is about 25 pounds, which is well under 50 pound carry-on weight restriction. So it's not, as I'm finding, it's not so much the planes that are the problem, it's me, because I'm not sure how far I can go with 50 pounds. I haven't yet, at least at the time of recording this, worked up to doing a full 1 or 2 mile walk, and this is on flat ground, on pavement. I haven't worked up to doing a full 1 or 2 mile walk with 50 pounds in my pack. So that's something that I hadn't really anticipated, and I feel stupid for saying this, because I really should have anticipated that it wasn't going to be flying that would be the problem. It's going to be carrying this stuff all day, and I've carried reasonably solid amounts of camera gear in the past for better parts of a day. But this, with the fact that I'm taking water and taking a tripod that I wouldn't normally have had or didn't have in the past, that adds weight that I hadn't anticipated for some reason. So, yeah, the real problem isn't so much as I'm finding out is not so much that it's airline carry-on weight restrictions. It's physical me carrying weight restrictions. It also I'm re-understanding the importance of good backpack. And I would say that the Ajna is a good backpack. It's a good hiking backpack. It's got beefy waist belt, you know, or reasonably good waist belt, good suspension, good support, good you know, internal frame to distribute the load, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I do have to reiterate the point that the one thing I think that the F-stop gear really screwed the pooch on with this bag is that they went with thinner straps and thinner pads on the waist belt than the next model up, the Tilapia. And I had, originally I was going to get the Tilapia, and I had decided just before I ordered it, and I maybe regretted it, and I maybe should still regret it, but I had decided that I was going to not get the Tilapia. I was going to get the Ajna because it was a little bit smaller. And my concern was largely that if I had a bigger bag, I'd find things to put in it to take, and I would fill it up, and it would be more weight. And because I've done this before, I get a reasonably, you know, I get a camera bag with the thought process of, oh, well, you know, it's not quite, or it's bigger than I need right now, but I'll grow into it or whatever. And then it becomes, oh, I just stuck everything I possibly could put in it and own and have. And I didn't have to think about anything. And then I had a bag that was 40 pounds or 30 pounds or whatever and was just heavy. So my gripe, though, is that honestly, F-stop gear designed these bags kind of as hiking packs. And I think they made a mistake. And the mistake I think they made is when you're filling a pack up with clothes or a sleeping bag or, you know, that kind of thing, the density just isn't quite there. Shirts are not glass and steel or glass and magnesium or glass and aluminum. And I think they should have put the heavier or the more padded shoulder straps on all of their bags, not just the bigger, heavier packed ones. At the same time, the back, I can't say the straps are terrible. I think they could just be better. That is where I'm at right now. Of course, I'm getting closer to doing some full-on, full-up gear tests with, you know, everything loaded and packed and what I would anticipate to be wearing and so forth. And I'll know more, you know, when I do that for sure. But in the stuff that I've done so far, the straps are not terrible, but they could be a lot better. That I think that they could have been a lot better padded. Of course, what I may end up doing is I may end up just making or throwing together some pads for them so that they can be as padded as I want them or not, based on whether or not I need them to be padded. But, you know, anyway, that's sort of a topic for revisiting when I discuss or, you know, when I do a full review of the Ajna. So I've got a list of things kind of that I'm looking at. And one of the things I want to move on, this has been is increasingly becoming a bugaboo for me, is that camera bags are not designed for lens hoods. Everybody you see whenever you look at the marketing material from F-stop Gear, from Think Tank, rarely if ever do you see the lenses have the hoods on them and stowed in the stowed position or on them at all. And I can understand where this is, you know, reasonable from a marketing perspective, but from an actual use perspective, I use lens hoods. I use them in part for their, you know, image quality benefits in terms of shading, but I use them a lot for just protection. That it's, you know, a plastic thing that prevents the front of the lens from being the front and center out there and from getting scratched. And on a lens like the Canon 24-70 f2.8, the original one, not the new one, you have a really big lens hood, and at 70 millimeters, the front element's way back and well recessed and really well protected. And, you know, that's a one of the lenses and one of the hoods that I use, you know, pretty much all the time almost, because of the protection that it offers in terms of, you know, if I'm hiking with the camera on a sling strap, like a Black Rapid strap, for example, I don't have to worry about the camera banging into stuff. I don't have to worry about having to have the lens cover on all the time, which could get knocked and bumped off. I don't, you know, it's, there's a whole lot of benefit, in my opinion, to this. And that, of course, completely, you know, is ignoring the fact that if you're shooting side on to the light or, you know, the sun, or you're shooting sort of, you know, with the sun in a quartering angle ahead of you, or, you know, in front of you, for, you know, that kind of images, your hood is not there to provide protection against flare and increased contrast. And it's frustrating. You know, in other trips, what I've done, especially like when I went to Alaska because of packing the hoods, I just packed the hoods, stuck a couple socks in them, and put them in the suitcase. And when I got to Alaska, I could pull them out and sort of tuck them in my bag somewhere, you know, or leave them sitting on the table. And because I didn't need to have, you know, everything was fixed, basically. It was sitting on the table in the room on the ship, and I didn't have a need to carry it with me everywhere. If I was going to go and take a lens, I could put the hood on the lens and throw it in my belt pack and go. But I didn't need to have it in my backpack. Well, on this trip, because I'm going to be hiking a lot, or walking a lot, or however you want to put it, I kind of need the hoods with me. And the size really does become, of the hoods, especially the hood for the original 24-70, really does become something of, you know, a problem. It's kind of, I don't really know where to put it. I don't really know how to address it. And it doesn't, like, I could tuck it around another lens, but the hood's still so big that even if I put it under my, say, 16-35, which has its hood's door, you know, the diameter of the 16-35 f4's hood is smaller than the diameter, the largest diameter of the 24-70's hood, and it doesn't really work there either. And this goes back to my sort of never-ending complaint with camera bag designs, in that they're not designed for hoods. And, I mean, I've always sort of complained that they're not designed for Canon lenses, because Canon lenses seem to be a little fatter in diameter than, say, Nikon lenses. And, but hoods especially are problematic. And, you know, I know there's people who use screw-on little, you know, rubber hoods and things like that. And you can always use your hand as a hood in, you know, when you need to. But, you know, like I said, I think, again, because of the situation, because I'm carrying my gear with me and I don't want to leave things, you know, like a hood in my suitcase in the room or something like that, it becomes an issue, you know, more of an issue to figure out how to pack all that. Now, fortunately, I have room in the top of the Ajna above the ICU such that, you know, where I'm going to have like a jacket and stuff in there, that I could tuck a hood or tuck the hood for my 24-70 in there. And, you know, kind of, I'd still have it with me, but I wouldn't have as big of a deal as having it in the case. But it, you know, would be a lot nicer if I could just yank it out when I pull the lens out, you know, having it on the lens. So moving on from hoods, I've long sort of complained about Canon's battery situation with their pro cameras. I'm going to just paraphrase it here instead of going on the tirade again, but the situation is basically this. Canon's One Series EOS 1DX cameras use a different battery than the batteries that are used in the 5D and 7D series. And okay, that's obvious because it's a integral battery grip, etc., etc., etc. The battery grips for the 5D and 7D and 5DS are not designed to support taking the batteries from the One Series. And the result of this is, if, because The One series, they don't make a 50 megapixel EOS One that if you're doing something where you're shooting, say, wildlife and landscape, and you need high frame rate from an EOS One, 10, 15, 16 frames a second, for you know, action of the wildlife, and you want high resolution, so like a 50 megapixel 5DSR for landscapes, you run into a situation where you have two cameras with two completely incompatible battery systems that you have to have two different chargers for. And there's a lot of stuff Canon could do to alleviate that. I alleviated it on this trip and going forward by simply not using One Series cameras. That's not to say that I won't get a One Series body in the future at some point again, but when I went to Alaska, I took a 5D Mark III and a 1D Mark III, and the 1D Mark III was my backup body in case I had a problem with my 5D Mark III. And for this trip, I'm taking a 5D Mark IV and a 5D Mark III, and that's it. And they both use the same batteries. They don't use the same battery grips, but they both use the same batteries and the same chargers, and that dramatically simplifies things, as I expected it to. What I didn't expect was just how much more efficient it would turn out to be. So both my 5Ds have battery grips. Both my 5Ds have battery grips, and both battery grips will hold two batteries. And if the camera is off and in the bag, it pretty much doesn't use any power, at least any noticeable or concernable power. And so very spare batteries. In Alaska, I took a full set of spare batteries for my 5D, so two batteries, and a full set of spare batteries for my 1D, so an extra battery. On this trip, I can very much, because I'm not planning on shooting with the two cameras simultaneously, even though I could, I can very much just use the batteries in the 5D Mark III, the backup camera, as spare batteries. They aren't going to drain because the camera is off, and they're handy, and they don't take up any more room in the bag. And I had not really anticipated this level of efficiency when I started this whole sort of, whatever you want to call it, issue, discussion on batteries, or transition. It was a top, I won't say a top priority, it was a high thing in my mind when I was looking at cameras, because, you know, when the 1DX Mark II came out, I was kind of like, ooh, that's nice. And there's some things that I wouldn't mind, like 50 frame per second 4K video. But the price tag compared to the 5D Mark IV was kind of, dissuading on that matter. But, you know, I had kind of already anticipated not going with another 1D anytime soon and going with a 5D, a replacement 5D, you know, so the Mark IV in this case. And like I said, it's hard to overstate the efficiency that can be gained by not having all kinds of competing or conflicting or non-interchangeable or incompatible stuff. So as far as, again, goes going for packing for hiking, so packing for carrying my gear, is what I found is that having the second battery or the second body with a battery grip on it that's strictly there as a backup, it's not something I intend to be using unless I absolutely have to. And, you know, even though I know I can get good pictures out of it, so it's not like I wouldn't use it if the opportunity presented. But the fact that I don't have to carry a battery pack or a pouch with batteries in it. I don't have to carry, you know, a whole slew of extra batteries. I can really run off four batteries and keep the spares in the spare camera. And that actually has a efficiency advantage in some ways, potentially, in packing the bags, assuming I keep the battery grip on the camera. If I take the battery grip off, then I'm, you know, it's a different situation. So I guess that leads me on to the next point, which is backup body or not, really. I'm taking it because, you know, well, my intent was to take one and this goes back to the reasoning that I had with Alaska, is photography is my primary interest on this trip. It's a family vacation. There's other stuff involved, but my principal interest is to go take pictures. And if my ability to take pictures is compromised, well, that sort of ruins the whole thing for me. It especially was the case in Alaska. The American Southwest is in some ways a little bit more accessible. It's cheaper to get there. It's cheaper to go back and shoot something if I have to go back or want to go back to do something specific. But my reasoning still stands. Having a backup body means that if something happens to my primary body, which, you know, shouldn't happen, but it could, I have the ability to continue going at perhaps a slightly diminished quality level. Obviously, the 5D Mark III does not have the image quality of the 5D Mark IV. And so, you know, there's a slight difference there or whatever. But I still know, because I have great pictures from Alaska, that I can shoot great pictures on a 5D Mark III. So it's not a total write-off. The counter side or point or whatever to having a backup body is that you're carrying a backup body, and a Canon full-frame DSLR with a battery grip is like 3 pounds, and that's 3 pounds of gear you're carrying that you weren't carrying before, and that's 2 lenses worth of space in the bag, for example, that is being taken up by a camera and not, say, 2 lenses or something to that effect. I keep flip-flopping on this. I go from going, well, don't take it, or don't take the backup, to, well, just take the backup, but take the battery grip off, because you don't really need the battery grip on the camera. You could run it without the battery grip, and I can always pull the plate that I've cut up and hacked on to, you know, my Mark IV for the Mark III if I need to without a battery grip. So there's that option. But then if I take the battery grip off, I have to figure out what I'm going to do with the spare batteries. I can't just store them in the camera. I actually have to devote space in the bag to storing them. And that becomes a space efficiency kind of issue. And like I said, there's a bit of back and forth on that. Some of it actually comes down to the fact that the camera gear just doesn't pack neatly. Anybody who's tried packing it has probably realized this. It's not like 1-2-3 blocks or something like that, where, you know, 2 of them together is the same as 1 of them on the side, and, you know, or whatever. Like, you can't, they're not Legos. They don't stack together into nice compact things. You have round lenses of various diameters. You have cameras of odd shapes and various widths and heights, and, you know, the camera might be 2 small lenses wide, but not really 1 long lens tall or something like that. And it becomes a, you know, matter of, you know, let's just say, for sake of argument, I take the battery grip off my backup body, and I go and I take, you know, I keep 1 battery in that camera body, and I keep another battery in a battery pouch. That battery pouch and that space freed up doesn't necessarily inherently translate to more usable space in terms of carrying other gear. And in terms of weight savings, not having the battery grip is less than 1 pound, really, of weight savings, which if I was super ultra light hack, you know, hiking camera or whatever, that would be something worth, you know, considering or worrying about. But I'm not at a point where I think 1 pound really is going to make a difference. Going from 36 pounds to 35 pounds or 45 pounds to 44 pounds isn't going to alleviate the load, so to speak. But it's something to think about. It's something to think about if you're taking, if it's a personal thing, if it's, you're not shooting for a client or something like that, do you really need the backup body? This is a personal trip, but I'm still on the not sure I really want to give up the backup body thing. So, you know, on a similar topic, if you will, carrying redundant focal length lenses. So, for example, I'm taking my 24-70 f/2.8 and I'm taking my 24-105 f/4. And they both cover essentially the same range. Yeah, the F4 is longer, the F4, and there's a reasoning behind this logic for me. And it's essentially that I'm going to be doing this aerial photography or this aerial doors off helicopter thing, and it's suited for photography, and they understand that, and they actually even reserve seats for people who are interested in photography or photographers who are flying, so you sit in a good spot with a clear field of view out the side of the helicopter and so forth. And, or at least that's what they've said. We'll find out, obviously. But in doing a bunch of research on aerial photography, what I very much came down to is, you know, there's a whole lot of schools of thought, and they're all dictated by what you're going to do. And but what you can't do is change lenses. And I don't want to take two cameras because that's more gear for me to try and carry and have. So I'm really working on the premise of one camera and one lens, and the lens kind of got to do it all. Long lenses obviously would let you reach out and get pictures of things, you know, reach out to things, so to speak. And wide lenses don't. The downside of long lenses is that when you're in a helicopter and you're moving, things are, the angles are changing, that there's a real high shutter speed requirement for keeping motion frozen, because normally you might be in a car going, you know, just say you were taking pictures from a car or a boat, you know, you would be doing a couple of miles an hour, whereas in a helicopter, you're doing maybe 100, and that's a lot of miles an hour. I mean, even if you're in a powerboat doing 50 miles an hour and you're going to a helicopter doing 100 is still twice as fast. It's, you know, and so everything I've read has basically said fast shutter speeds, extremely fast shutter speeds if you're using a long lens to get motion stopped. On the other hand, a wide angle lens can be useful for getting better, you know, broader scenics, broader panoramas, that kind of thing in one shot, because you don't really want to have to try stitching things. Or at least I'm not sure I want to try stitching things. So originally I was going to take a 70 to 200 for this, and then I went, well, you know, long lenses and the telephoto and the motion and all of that, 70-200 might not be the right tool. It might be too much on the long end. And I'd have my 24-70, and my concern there was, of course, that I wouldn't have enough long end because it ends at 70. And I don't have a, like, 28-300 or 35-300 or something like that. So, you know, that's kind of a non-starter cassette, but that would be kind of like the ideal lens in a sense, except Canon's is huge. But of course, so anyway, my point was, is that's why I'm taking two lenses that cover the same focal length, and we're primarily covered to the same focal lengths. But of course, that means carrying an extra lens, essentially. And, you know, there's a trade-off in that. You know, lenses, especially zoom lenses, are always compromises. Well, everything's a compromise. But lenses, especially zoom lenses, are compromises. You're compromising image quality for flexibility. But from a packing perspective, the more you're carrying is a compromise. So you're carrying, compromising image quality to weight and space. And, you know, how's the best way to sort of resolve that? Do you assume that you're not going to have the ideal, you know, lens for a certain thing, or do you give up not having the what potentially could be a better lens for a certain task, like having the 24-105 for the flight, for having a pound and a half or whatever that lens caught weighs less lens in your bag, or for some other gear? An example being that one of the things that I had originally intended to bring was an audio recorder and my binaural microphone, so that while I was in or walking on a trail in Zion or the Grand Canyon or whatever, I could do a binaural recording and come home and put headphones on and listen as if I was there. And I may still take them if I can figure out how to stuff them in somewhere, but there's a you know, obviously, if I dropped the 24-105, I'd have room for him straight away, as opposed to having to try and figure out how to take that extra gear, or deciding not to take it at all because, you know, I'm not going to have other stuff with me. I'm not going to have, I'm not going to be shooting video. I'm not going to have a head-mounted GoPro or anything like that. I would just be shooting audio or recording audio. And, you know, that's a, there's a thought in there. You know, the same thing is obviously, like, if I had an unlimited budget, that upgrading glass, say, to the new Canon 24-105 f/4 L, that I potentially could not take the 24-70 because I would now have something that had much more respectable image quality in the corners, potentially. Of course, the lens is so new that getting a lot of good reviews is, or good reviews on it are still kind of few and far between. And I'm not even sure if you can get it yet, but, you know, there's always that thought process too, in terms of, you know, having budget available to switch things out. Because, I mean, while it might compromise my astrophotography intentions, not having a fast lens, not having to carry an extra lens, might actually not compromise my back, or something to that effect. And that kind of actually brings me to a third point that I was on lenses, is special purpose lenses, macro lenses, a fast prime for astrophotography. Good astrophotography requires that you shoot, if you're not shooting star trails, you have a lower limit for how, or an upper limit for how long your shutter speed can be. And so if you have a slower lens, you have to have more ISO, because you're kind of, like video, constrained to a certain shutter speed. Again, not going to get into it in this episode. I think I'll talk about it in a future episode, but the whole sort of deal with astrophotography. But for astrophotography, it'd be real handy to have something like a 24 f/1.4. Well, I don't own one. I could rent one. They're not terribly, terribly expensive to rent for 3 weeks, but I could rent one, but then I have to carry it, and I have to find a place for it, and I have to find a place, you know, what do I leave that I'm otherwise taking? Like I said, one of the things I mentioned was macro. So macro is actually sort of an interesting discussion, because especially if you're a Canon user, if you're Nikon or whatever, you're kind of a bit more limited as far as I know. But Canon, you know, the traditional macro solution is basically you get a macro lens and you get one-to-one magnification. And I have a macro lens, a Sigma 150mm f2.8 macro. And in my experience, I hardly ever shoot at 100% magnification. Most things I want to shoot are close-up, but not technically macro. Now, on Canon's side of things, and I'm not taking my macro lens. I have no point in taking my macro lens because of what I've just said, that things don't are close up. They're not necessarily 100. In my experience, what I shoot, things are close up, not one to one macro. But there are alternatives. Now, of course, there's alternatives that are available to anyone, which is extension tubes or a close-up lens. Screw the close-up lens on the front, extension tubes go on the back, it allows the lens to focus closer, and you can get better magnification. Where I said Canon has advantages is they have two lenses, the 24-70 f/4 that has a macro mode that gets 0.7x magnification and is a 24-70 walk-around general-purpose zoom. The other thing is their new 100 to 400 f/4 5-5.6L zoom, the Mark II version of that. If you put a teleconverter on that at 400mm on the lens, you will get 0.48 or 0.44. It's pretty close to 0.5x magnification with a really nice working distance and really clean backgrounds, because at 800 or 560mm, your angle of view is, you know, so narrow that the backgrounds just become amazingly clean, pretty much regardless of what you're shooting. Depth of field is still minuscule, but depth of field's always minuscule for macro work anyway. So you know, and with a 2X teleconverter, it actually gets even better, but I don't have a 2X teleconverter and I don't really care that much. 50% magnification is, you know, close enough for me. But again, with the whole special purpose lenses and packing things, I'm already taking, so this works out in my favor as a Canon guy with the situation. I'm already taking my 100 to 400. I'm already taking a 1.4 teleconverter. And boom, right there, I've got a 0.5x approximately, roughly, macro setup that I will have available anytime I need it, and I'm not carrying extra gear. And I'm taking the lens and the teleconverter strictly for the purpose of being able to shoot wildlife if I run across it. May not need the teleconverter, may need the teleconverter, don't know. So one final sort of chunk of gear that I want to talk about is flashes. Do you take them? If you take them, there's another battery situation again, right? Because flashes run off of AA batteries. And I mean, I wrote an article about maybe they'd be nice, or I think it might be nice if they would run off the same batteries as my cameras did, in which case, you know, I could just take a couple more camera batteries and have a flash, you know, sort of for free. But taking a flash means I have to take AA's. Well, I don't have to take AA's, but if I take, I use rechargeables. I use Anazon Basics high capacity, load self discharge, nickel metal hydride rechargeable batteries. If you're not aware, the gold standard for a long time have been Sanyo Eneloops. Sanyo was purchased by Panasonic, and the factories and formulation that the Eneloop batteries are made from was transferred to Fujitsu Heavy Industry. Panasonic took the brand, went to their, with their chemistry, went to China and started making really expensive Eneloops that weren't really high quality, or as good of quality, I should say. And the good quality Sanyo chemistry Eneloops were being made by Fujitsu, who Amazon contracted to manufacture Amazon Basics batteries. And so the Amazon Basics high capacity, low self-discharge nickel metal hydride AA's and AAA's, at least if they say made in Japan, and insofar as I can tell, are the really high quality, batteries. I shouldn't say the really high quality. They are really high quality batteries. And I have pretty much subsumed all of my using Sanyo Eneloops for using these Amazon Basic batteries. But anyway, that's sort of a side tangent. But so I take a flash. Take batteries, spare batteries for it. Four in the flash. I have a nice soft case that'll hold eight more. Battery charger. Do I take one? Do I not take one? I'm not going to take one because I don't anticipate using my flash that much. And the only other thing that I'm carrying that uses AA's is my flashlight, and it only uses one. And so four AA's will last me forever. It gives me 4.5 hours at the highest power setting in my flashlight. So it'll last me pretty much all I can imagine needing to use my flashlight for on this trip. But again, flashes are, with the whole stacking and camera things, they don't fit nicely with everything. They're funny shaped. They're not as big around as a lens. They're kind of flat. So that raises a challenge in packing it. Right now, I've got it folded in the on-camera use position because that makes it fit in my bag in a vertical pouch, or however you want to put it, stuck in a lens pouch or lens compartment thing. But then there's dead space. How do you do with dead space? I've got a teleconverter in the dead space, but I'm not sure that's the greatest idea either, because that teleconverter is plastic to plastic with the flash and metal to plastic with the flash. And, you know, do I want to scratch up the flash? Not really. Do I want to scratch up the teleconverter? Again, not really. So, you know, I've got to work that out again. Again, do I need a flash? You know, I'm not anticipating taking my better beamer, which if I'm going to use a flash for wildlife, I kind of should take that because I need to reach out and light something, so to speak. But if I don't take it, is that enough to say not take the flash? Anyway, all of this stuff, and again, all of this stuff is going back to weight on my back that I'm carrying, or on my waist, really, because I actually do know how to wear a backpack properly with a waist belt and so forth. And the food for thought. You know, if you're carrying this stuff and you're only taking the thing because, well, I maybe should take it. Do you really need it? Is it that important to have? I don't have an answer for that, obviously, yet. I'm still going back and forth on things, and I'm really throwing this out in a hope that, you know, anybody listening to this, anybody going through the motions of packing for a bag or for a trip or for hiking or for travel that hasn't done it before, hasn't done it in a while and hasn't thought about it, or has done it and has some thoughts on it, obviously on Points in Focus in the on the article that's associated with this. It's there's a comment section. You know, I'd love to have some hear some feedback. If you have some ideas on how to do something better or what to do better, but you know, like I said, I'm throwing this out there because I can't be. I'm not the only person who is packing for a trip and has to think about all the stuff that they have to have and that they're carrying and that they're taking with them. And I'm not the only person out there who doesn't really want to carry a 50-pound bag all day if they can avoid it. And so trying to figure out better, you know, what's necessary and what isn't is sort of relevant. And I don't know, maybe there's just some food for thought in here. But in any event, until next time, thank you for listening. And if you're new, like I said, thank you for joining me and subscribe pointsinfocus.com/podcast. And until next time.